Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Robert. I am delighted that you and I have been able to connect. I think we've been connected for quite some time on social media, probably crossed paths in webinars and LinkedIn conversations or something of the sort. And we decided recently, hey, let's get you on the podcast and have a meaningful conversation. I'm delighted that we're here this morning. I've got my cup of coffee. I know you've got yours. And we're going to wrap up this. We're not quite wrapping up this week of the inauguration. It's kind of it's a brand new day. Yesterday, we inaugurated a new president. And I'm sort of pepping my step this morning. So how about you? Why don't you introduce yourself and tell our audience who you are?
Thanks, Jason. Like I said, we've been following each other for some time. I'm a big fan of you and your work that you do. So this is great. So, like most fundraisers, I backed into fundraising. So my background is in law. So quick story, when I went to law school, I got married after my first year of law school. So my wife and I are on our honeymoon. And at one point she turned to me and she said, hey, what area of law are you going to practice when you graduate? And I said, oh, I don't have any intention on practicing law. I just think it's a great education to have. And the look that your new bride gives you of what the heck did I just get into? But it actually worked out well. So, after law school, went into banking for a little bit. Worked for a company in Chicago, a bank in Chicago, and worked mostly on the trust side. So did corporate trust to begin with, and then got into estate administration, personal trust, and really really enjoyed estate planning, estate administration, trust work. So got into that. Did that for a few years and then moved on to a small town in Illinois to head up a trust department for a small community bank in Galesburg, Illinois. Did that for about 4 years and then got the itch to practice law. So tried that for a little bit, figured I was going to be in a small town. I could be that estate planning attorney. Went well, but I ended up doing a lot of other things that kind of took me away from that focus. So about that time, a good friend of mine who was working for a liberal arts college there in town said, hey, Bob, I could use someone for planning or plan giving. Would you be interested? And I said, if I never have to do another divorce case, you bet. So that was kind of my way I backed into fundraising. And once I got into it, I knew that this is a perfect area for to join what I love to do, working with individuals, helping them work through issues, helping them focus on, you know, a better way to do things, and thinking about their ultimate goals. So that was the best part about me for kind of backing into this job. And since then, I've enjoyed a great career at a small liberal arts college. From there, I went to the University of Houston, did gift planning there, ended up fundraising for the College of Business there for a couple of years. Moved to Kansas City to work for a non-for-profit to kind of get out of the higher ed space to get some experience in that. And then just recently had the opportunity to join the University of Iowa Center for Advancement, which is my new position, and that's getting into healthcare fundraising. So kind of moved
around. Wow. I'm working on a book project. Before we dive into our subject, I got to get your comments on this, because I'm listening. I'm sitting here sort of reading in between the lines of the way you just introduce yourself. So I'm working on this book project that talks. I'm distinguishing between sort of the mechanical sciences, sort of the way the Enlightenment way of thinking that we got from Descartes and during the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, and introducing this notion of complexity, which is sort of a living science. And it occurs to me that someone like yourself, who's got a law background, who sort of has done the work, when we talk about complexity, we're looking at a living, less than reductionist sort of way of seeing the world. But we're also looking for patterns. And I have to imagine that somewhere in the work that you've done, and perhaps beginning with law, you wanted to sort of work and engage with people, which is certainly what you do in law, and it's certainly what we do. But you also appreciated the idea that there's very consistent patterns. Like, law typically follows certain patterns, and you sort of see particular human behavior. Am I sort of following? Are you following my thinking there?
I am. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that part of the reason why you think you were able to? Because I do see. I have over the 20 plus years in fundraising, I've noticed that people with law backgrounds have gravitated towards fundraising, but I don't know that I've ever thought much about it, about why that necessarily is. Is that perhaps some of the reason why it is because you appreciate sort of the structure and the sort of the way law works and the way that we sort of see that world, but also the idea that it requires, and it also would seem to me maybe fundraising is a little more optimistic and positive. Like you say, you could avoid some of those negotiating divorces and custody battles and all those sorts of things. So you're sort of seeing the more generous, positive side of humanity. Am I right?
Yeah, you really do. And I tell a lot of folks that, you know, when they ask you, kind of boil down the essence of who you are. I like to be an advisor, and I think a lot of the times, when you've practiced law, or when you've kind of got that law background, you know, you're trained to be an advocate for your client. Which is great, because obviously everyone deserves that type of representation. You're working on their best interest, but also you kind of pull that back and say, okay, you separate the advocate versus advisor. And you know, there might be a fine line there, but I think part of what that line is, an advisor does have that tendency to be able to pull back and say, okay, you know, let me take in a different area over here. I'm not just solving a problem and being your advocate to getting you to a solution, but let me look at the broader picture for you and help you make those decisions. Like, you know, I'm not going to make them for you. We'll be out of the context about, you know, like with law, you know, if you're in a courtroom, or if you're in a lawsuit, okay, I know the roadmap, I know where the landmines are. I'm going to navigate you through that.
Yeah.
And you have to trust me because I'm going to get you there. Whereas that advisor, I think you have that role to play, hey, tell me more about what you're thinking, and then build that out with the client. And so really kind of they're building their own roadmap where they want to go. And again, with the positive aspect of it, yeah, it's not confrontational. It really is kind of that, how do you add value to their life and get them to a better place in a better area with what they want to do?
Yeah, there's a... I know where our conversation's going, and but I don't want to tee it up too soon, because I want to sort of hang on this for a minute. The thought will come back to me. Robert, we always ask our guest to come with a big idea or bold opinion. I know the conversation we're going to have this morning's a familiar one to me, and it's certainly something that we in 200 plus episodes of the Fundraising Talent Podcast have not talked about. So what is that?
The big idea is the concept of a curious chameleon, something I've been an advocate for, gosh, pretty much since I first saw this infographic from the Education Advisory
Yeah, EAB, right.
Yep. And that's just when I first saw that, it was just, you know, when those lights come on, that was the light. I'm like, yes, this is perfect. This is what I want to be, and this is what I'm looking for in people I work with as well. So,
yeah. Okay. That was the thought that you refreshed my memory. So, and this will get this one going. Cause I love the EAB Curious Chameleon study too. I actually quoted it in my first book, use it all the time in my seminars. Robert, there's one of my big critiques about the way that fundraising gets done is not so much about us on the front line doing the fundraising, but it's the expertise and the experts in the room. People are privileged to stand behind the podium or stand up in the front of a breakout session and oftentimes sort of, in my mind, sort of come across in a very arrogant sort of predictive deterministic sort of framework where fundraising sort of works this way. They're sort of always, in my mind, projecting this notion that there's one best way to do fundraising and that if you don't sort of follow this formulaic sort of way of doing things. And I think if you think about your earlier comments as you were introducing yourself, you think about this notion of curiosity, and you think about law, there's a contextual sort of humility that even the most experienced, most professional lawyer has to have. He or she has to sort of sit back in his or her chair and appreciate and sort of gather context before they start to sort of hinge on their expertise. Am I right?
Absolutely.
I mean, and that is that curiosity that is the curiosity.
Without question, the two words I keep going back to all the time are context and perspective.
Yeah.
And you know how you have to understand those and how you gain that, but how that's always evolving too. And that's, again, that's wrapped up in that piece about being curious is, you know, you understand a context, but you can also manipulate that, you know, based on the information, the factors you're taking in, but then your perspective is changing as well. And it's always based on that curiosity about, am I looking at this the right way? You know, what is this that I'm working with? And then always keeping that in mind. So, and always asking questions. So,
you can't have, as a fundraiser, I mean, how often do we try to, I'm sure you've done some coaching and some advising to young fundraisers. I mean, how often do we have to tell fundraisers to shut their mouths, right? Stop talking. Just listen. I mean, my colleague and I were working with a client, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and she was accompanying this gentleman, this older gentleman, on these calls. He was trying to raise money for his cause, and it was a very extraordinary cause, right? And at one point, she said, we'll call him Bob for the sake of, you know, she said, Bob, you're just gonna have to shut up. You have to stop talking, right? and she couldn't. And I think it caught, you know, I was in the room and anyway, it clicked. So Robert, what is it about you? Help me understand what it is about Robert. I'm always trying to figure out fundraising talent. So individuals who gravitate, say, go on a professional path like you were on, perhaps looking at other things, end up in fundraising and feel like they're really thriving in that space. What is it about you that sort of from your childhood, maybe, or as a young adult, sort of made you curious? Why are you curious? I mean, is something your mom or dad got instilled in you, or?
You know, I haven't given a lot of thought in a long time, but, you know, there was a time, I guess, yeah, just as a kid growing up, and this is, you know, obviously, you know, back in the early 70s.
Sure.
Back when you actually had to, you know, look at books, but I remember asking my mom questions, you know, and just, hey, what about this? Or, you know, those things you'd see and you'd ask. And a lot of times her answer was, we bought this World Book Encyclopedia set, go look it up. So I remember clearly at the end of a hallway, we used to have this, you know, set of encyclopedias set up. And it was just, you go pull a book out and you start looking up the different information. And encyclopedias just, you know, it always amazed me. And, you know, so you can sit there and just look at stuff all the time and start to, and you, when you learn how to read, you're like, oh, this is great. It had pictures. It, you know, did everything. So I guess really, in kind of the big way, just looking at that volume, those volumes that were out there, 26 volumes or 24 volumes, and then everything that was inside of there, you're like, there's so much knowledge right there. And it's always changing as well. You know, there are updates. So, it was just that idea of, well, if you have an idea, go research it, go look it up, go try to find information and satisfy that curiosity and see where it leads you to. So, and then, you know, and then that curiosity carries over into not just about, things or events, but really about people. And, to me, people are the ultimate curiosity, because you can always, there's always something more to find out about.
Right. There's always something more there. Right. And I think I've been doing, like I said, I'm working on this book project. And one of the things that is different from several of these authors that I've been reading talk about the sort of the way that our worldview has changed since the Industrial Revolution, the beginning of the 20th century to now, at the first two decades of the 21st century. And a lot of it is this way, this reality that our world is much more our posture in the world is much more exploratory as opposed to exploitive. So an exploitive isn't necessarily used in the most derogatory negative sense, but if you think about what the Industrial Revolution was all about doing, it was all about figuring out, tinkering with things, creating these large machines and sort of exploiting the machine to create the most output at the least cost.
Right.
Manufacturing, everything from little trinkets that we hold in our hands to the laptops and the computers and everything eventually and the cell phones, but starting with, automobiles and stuff. It was just mass production of whatever you could at the least cost. And so, exploiting that machine's capability was so much what the world was defined by. But the world now, what a couple of these authors are talking about is we're in a much more exploratory sort of. We've got all the stuff we need. We don't need to manufacture much more. We've got enough in our, I don't need any more stuff. And that of being an explorer. I have to imagine you in the midst of COVID-19 right now, for example, you miss that opportunity of sort of hopping in the car, going on an adventure, landing at a coffee shop, landing at a, driveway of somebody's home and sort of exploring that relationship. Am I right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, when you talk about the, the fun of this job, that's fun. That
right.
is just, yeah. It's that, because there's always something, and I guess it's that element of there's always something new there. If that's attractive, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. Do you work with a team? What's the sort of, do you work with a group of other curious chameleons, or at times do you feel like you're, the reason I asked, there's a guy up in the Northeast that frustrates me because he's always sort of selling fundraising through this lens of sales. And I'm not an anti-sales guy. I think sales is great. I do my own sort of sales in my own business. But the notion of sort of always sort of selling, I think in some ways diminishes the opportunity to sort of be exploratory and curious. Do you work for a team that's always sort of comparing fundraising to sales, or are you comparing it to other things?
There, my newest team, it's always comparing to other things. So it's not about sales. And I am totally on board with you when it comes to this, comparing fundraising to sales and that thing about, it's the same thing. We're doing sales. Well, you know what? My take on that has always been, if you tell a donor you're sitting across from and trying to engage with and trying to build your credibility and trying to help them, if you tell them you're in sales, they immediately have a picture of what that means. And if you come across as a salesperson, no offense to our sales colleagues.
Sure, totally.
But from a donor's perceptive, it's okay, you just turn this, because you hear sales, you think transaction.
Yeah.
If people don't want transactions, they want relationships. So I try to mellow this out when it comes to that comparison and say, hey, look, if you want to compare fundraising to sales, think about it in terms of those key account sales, those sales folks, those long-term relationships where you're actually adding value to the client relationship. And you do have a two-way, but understand what your key accounts are rather than just that transaction. Because if you just keep in that transaction world, you're never going to build the depth of relationship that you need to actually to invite that donor into where you want them to be from your perspective, but where they want to be as well, where you get that mutual benefit relationship. So
one of the things I don't think we think about too much, and there was an exchange, you've probably seen these conversations that happen on LinkedIn a lot, and we're talking about sales as it relates to fundraising, And I don't think that when we compare it to sales, marketing, PR, those sorts of consumer sciences sort of things, I don't think we think enough about the idea that implicitly in that comparison, we're assuming that the donor is a consumer. I have to imagine that in your legal training and when you're sitting there being curious, you know, Walmart and Target and McDonald's, all these people that sort of see me and you as consumers, they have a particular way of sort of seeing the world and the way things are going to work. But I can't imagine an attorney, for example, necessarily looks at their client across the desk and necessarily sees them first and foremost as a consumer, do they?
It really depends on what that practice is. There's certainly, when you talk about law, you usually talk about transactions and litigation. It's kind of the two tracks that you're in. So from a transaction standpoint, let's say you hire an attorney to do a real estate deal for you. I mean, they've already priced it out in their head. This is the amount of time that it takes to fill out the templates and provide you a service. Yes, but there's an endpoint to it. Here's the scope of our relationship. You spell that out. This is all I'm going to do for you. Anything outside of that, I'm not responsible for. So it can be transactional that way. But if you think about it in terms of if somebody comes to an attorney with a problem and says, here's the situation I'm in, or here's what I'm dealing with, and it's okay, let's parse that out. Then you start to get into that. Okay, now it is a relationship. Yes, there's still a scope of representation, and you do have some boundaries, which relationships naturally have. But it's I'm trying to help you. I'm gonna walk. It's that I'm walking beside you instead of sitting in front of you, kind of thing. So when you take it out of that transaction realm, you actually think how you're going to expand that or what you're going to do within the confines of that relationship, and not so much breadth but depth of that relationship. That to me is the difference. So, or a big part of the difference.
You might be familiar with Irving Berlin told a story. He told a story about he compared foxes and hedgehogs. Are you familiar with that comparison?
I'm not, but I'm curious now. Yeah, I haven't.
Yeah. So hedgehogs know one thing really, really well. They go deep. They know one thing. They're sort of experts at one thing, right? Whereas the fox knows a lot of things. Sort of just a little bit, just enough of a lot of things, right? So he or she, the fox, has a sort of a diversity of familiarity. So, and as I've read this, and this author Tetlock has written about foxes and hedgehogs and compared them, I have consistently thought, and more recently, some authors have talked about the idea that our world is better suited for foxes now than hedgehogs, because we can't it's not a world where over specialization really works for you anymore. You have to be sort of more of a generalist and interdisciplinary, if you will. And I have oftentimes thought that fundraising oftentimes pigeonholes us into being hedgehogs, very quickly. And so we don't get to, I had a guest on here just recently who was talking about how he really relished the opportunity to go into someone's home, get into their office, get into their living room or whatever, and sort of flip on that curious chameleon switch and look at the bookshelves and sort of pick up on what because there's inevitably, if you can sort of pick up on the books that the individual's reading, you can start a conversation and really sort of tap into that curiosity that you have. Shouldn't we be more fox-like, where we're okay with, going to the local Barnes and Noble and sort of just buy a diversity of books and read them? And I bet you'll be a better fundraiser. I mean, I don't think we have to know the science of all these transactions so much as we just need to know how to relate to people who sort of come from all different contexts. Am I right?
Well, yeah. And I think, I'll just give you my experience. One of the issues that I ran into is that when you're labeled a plan giving officer, or you go into that, you start to get into the, okay, wow, when you talk about plan giving, now you're starting to talk about the technicalities of, there's a lot of, obviously estate planning, tax law, business law that goes into it. You start to get into the technicalities of it.
Yeah.
And, I've got a presentation that I do that talks about, we got to reframe that conversation when it comes to plan giving, because if, and you know, Russell James has talked about this. You know, the two things you think about when you think about fine giving, or when donors hear that, you know, it's death or it's complicated. You know?
Yeah.
And how do you reframe that conversation? But, you know, so yeah, you got to try to pull out from that. Yeah, you know, we're not the, you know, the ultimate specialist who's just here to find the most, you know, here's the optimal point on the graph where, you know, your estate, you know, your estate situation, your income tax situation is perfect for giving, and this is it. We need that. But again, when we talk about context and perspective, is that the only thing that's driving a donor? No, it's not. It's usually what they want to accomplish. It's that impact piece of it. So you're right. So, you know, again, my perspective, when I was, you know, just labeled as a gift planning specialist or planned giving specialist, you know, you kind of get put in that box and you're like, no, I want to know the, you know, the context for this. I want to help this person put, you know, put that piece of it into a larger perspective for what they want to do. And if we can do that, then we're going to see the, you know, the growth, the build that goes on with the relationship, you know, to when they do the ultimate gift that they want to do. And then, you know, it's one of those situations, I guess, you think of in terms of when a donor says, okay, I've done my ultimate gift and I've done all I can, you want to ask them the question, and how do you feel about that? And if they say, I feel great, I feel fulfilled, I feel like I've satisfied a purpose in life. If you can hear that from your donor at any point, you're just like, that's, you know, that is the goal. So
do you know how to, this is, I'm sort of settling on this, curiosity mixed with your legal background. Does an attorney know how to sit in a room and not let their sort of their knowledge and expertise just sort of like throw it up on the desk? I mean, because isn't that what I think sometimes we fundraisers sort of get into the, you know, and certainly when you talk about some sort of highly technical scenario, I remember being in a seminar that I had mistakenly signed up for. It was like, I think I thought I was showing up for this. It was like a three or four, you know, these 3 or 4 day plan giving training programs that people who don't know their way around this stuff show up for. I thought I was signing up for like the freshman year 101 type course. And I ended up in like a 301 course with a bunch of CPA and legal types that were way further along. And what I realized is that if these guys didn't, and it was a lot of men, for example, and a lot of them had CPAs and stuff, I realized kind of along the lines of what you're saying, if these guys didn't know how to sort of switch off that very knowledgeable expertise that they came to the table with, they'd intimidate the hell out of the 65-year-old woman, widow, just lost her husband. She'd scare them to death. They just wanted Mrs. Smith, who just lost her husband a couple of years, and you're talking about sort of her estate plan and so forth, doesn't want to know that you're a guru at anything. She just wants to know that you care, and that that you'll ask about her grandchildren or something. Am I right?
You know, without question. And I'll go back. So I've got that infographic, the EAB Curious Chameleon infographic in my head. Two aspects of that is your linguistic flexibility.
Yes.
And strategic solicitation.
Yes.
And really, you know, again, when you're talking to someone, you want to try to match their, you know, their speech patterns, their inflections. You're trying to mirror back to them, because if you just come in saying, okay, I'm going to tell you everything I know, I'm listening, but I'm going to keep my own presentation style talking to you this way, so you're going to understand what I'm saying to you at each time, and I'm going to give you a lot of facts and figures. If you're talking to someone who's not a facts and figures type person, well, they're not hearing what you're saying, and you're not being strategic about how you're using the information that you know and how to help them. You have to put those two together. So I do see a lot of folks who, and you talk about that, you know, seminar that you signed up for. And I love those kind of seminars. I go to them, and right. I'm still off.
I enjoyed it, but they were an intimidating bunch. And I thought there were a number of times, you know, I thought, man, I couldn't get along with you guys. You guys would drive me bonkers. But it actually ended up being a pretty fun week. And they were all probably 10, 15 years older than I am, too. So they were, and they knew I had mistakenly showed up. So they were, I have to say, they were probably pretty adaptable chameleons themselves to give them.
Well, yeah. So, yeah. But again, some of those of it's meeting someone, it's meeting their expectations at the time, and how you work through those expectations. That's part of being curious. Is okay, where are you at in this process, and what are you trying to accomplish with this? And you know, again, what stage are you at? How do we get you where you want to go, or how do we help you tell your story enough that you start to realize where you want to go and then where we can help. I mean, we can plug in that expertise to say, okay, you've mentioned this. Here's some of the implications, ramifications, and outcomes and consequences of doing this. Let's figure out the pathway. So, it's kind of that, you can keep your eyes up, think of where you want to go until you have to look down at the road and make sure you're on the right path and where the stumbles are, and then you can look back up again.
You know, the my first couple fundraising positions I was in were in smaller shops, human service type organizations and parachurch organizations. And I got into a larger shop, started interacting with a lot of people in higher education and worked with a large health charity in Washington, D.C., and sort of started to sort of discern some of the differences between how, for example, higher education would understand how all this works versus, and that's probably about the same time when I started to run into things like the Curious Chameleon research that we're talking about. And it's that angst. The last 12 months, for example, have really frustrated me because we get these people, quote unquote, fundraising gurus who are constantly saying, keep asking. And yet a guy like you and a guy like me knows that when we look at a study like that, but we also know when we look at from, the first thing that always comes to mind when I think about the Curious Chameleon study is that strategic solicitation and just always asking, just constantly asking for money all the time. Just to me sounds like that exploitive sort of machine that's just trying to get the most output and perhaps not really worried about sort of the consequences of having that machine running, on overdrive all the time. Because strategic solicitation in that report, and for the sake of my listeners, and Robert, you could share this with us, any clarification, but if I'm not mistaken, the Curious Chameleon study that EIB did demonstrated they had basically researched like 1,300 major gift officers around the country. And they identified sort of this cream of the crop, top 5%, maybe it was even less than 5%. And they identified these personality sort of characteristics about these individuals. And that first, then they called them Curious Chameleons, very adaptable, curious people, enjoyed asking questions, could sort of sit back in the chair. And I'm sitting here thinking about sort of what you and I are talking about. You're mentioning the idea of sort of the linguistic adaptation, the ability to sort of morph what you're talking about. But that gets back to those foxes, right? The fox has to just know just a little bit about a lot of different things so that when they show up in someone's home, if they're not meeting with 65-year-old Mrs. Smith, they're meeting with, and in our world today, I mean, we just elected, you think about the way that the world has changed, right? Just in the last decade or so, the world doesn't look like a bunch of old white guys anymore. You're going to have to know how to, they don't look like you or me. You're going to have to know your donor. I just had another guest on here yesterday talking about the idea that as they're doing new acquisition, they're starting to, that pool of donors is notably more diverse than the same new acquisition file that they would have secured 10 or 20 years ago. This is a guy who's been in the field for 30 plus years. And he's saying the person who's writing him a $100 plus check is more likely now to be, a well-educated African-American woman from this part of the country rather than the assumption that it's going to be somebody that looks like you or me. I mean, isn't that where that curiosity comes from too? Because as soon as you get that $100 check, you're going to be trying to ask that person for a meeting.
Right. Exactly. Well, and again, it goes back to this, strategic solicitation. And I'd be interested to see, to really kind of dig into that study. Because, okay, if I'm meeting with someone who looks like me, who's fourth generation donor, their family's got a history of giving and they're giving. Well, okay. If I want to ask them for a gift on the first meeting, well, if I get the signal that they're ready to do that, sure, I'll do that. But you talk about, a new donor pool and who we're working with, which is great. We need that. Okay, I'm going to meet somebody who's, first generation, who's just now come into the resources that they want to use for giving. Well, let's find out a little bit more about that. I don't know enough about them. I can't take the, well, they look like me and they've been, come from a history of giving. Well, I can do this. Well, wait a minute. I'm sitting in front of that person going, hey, I talked to Buffy at the club the other day, and guess what? You can't think in those terms. So it's one of those. And again, you always got to be looking, we're curious about other people. You got to be curious about yourself. And am I adapting to the realities that I'm seeing around me, and how do I do that? Because if you don't, then that's when you become stale right away.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it was so my boss in Washington, D.C., I was about 7 or 8 years into my career, had worked with two small parachurch organizations, human service type parachurch organizations, like I said earlier. But my boss, who really gave me more opportunity to sort of advance in my career and really sort of let me get my feet onto the ground and out into the field doing major gift work in a way that I had not been given the opportunity to do she allowed me to very narrowly focus on developing that particular level of confidence in the work that I was doing. But what was also particularly intriguing was the work that we did together. Danielle is a African-American woman, very well-educated African-American woman, single woman. And here I am. She's about 10 years older than I am. So we sort of came from different worlds. And we got out into the field and we interacted with donors. And it was always intriguing. We talk about curiosity. It was always fascinating to sort of debrief after those meetings with Danielle. I remember we were in D.C., so we'd periodically go up to Philadelphia, we'd go up to New York, and sometimes we'd go up to Boston to make these solicitations together. And we'd debrief on sort of what she saw and what I saw. And there was always sort of this tension, and we certainly did. I mean, it was great. It was a lot of bantering, friendly banter, and arguing and debating and that sort of stuff. But isn't that some, I have to imagine, Robert, that's some of the curious, if you're a curious chameleon, you probably want that curiosity to sort of be present amongst your colleagues and your peers and even your boss and maybe even your board a little bit. It's not just sort of that externally oriented thought of, I want to be curious about my donors. I want to work with people who are curious.
It's one of those, you want it kind of in every aspect of your life. You want that to kind of prove who you are. It's your essence. I'm curious, and I want to be around people who share that curiosity, because that's the way I'm going to learn and grow, is if I can, you talk about exploitation by machines. Well, you as a machine, me as a machine, I want to exploit you because I want to know what you're curious about. I want to hear your feedback because, that helps me grow, and vice versa. I'm helping you grow. I'm bringing up new topics, new issues you haven't thought of. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. This is, let's riff off of this, the arts term, but that's, if you can build that across, all relationships. It kind of drives my wife crazy sometimes when I'm like, well, let's think about this. And she's like, just work hard. Right.
Yeah. So when my wife and I got married, she was actually the one working for a charitable organization at the time. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do with my career. I was still stumbling my way through first couple of years of college. And the organization that Erica was working for, speaking of wives here, the organization she was working for tried to enlist her. My wife's a very introverted, quiet, English major type, right? So the last thing in the world she wants to be obligated to do is get out in the field and always be introducing, shaking hands with people and stuff. It's just not in her nature. I have actually found that curious introverted individuals are actually rock stars at this work nonetheless, but they wanted her to do this grant writing, fundraising sort of stuff. That was the first interaction I had with fundraising, was sort of this naive understanding of how all this works. And they thought, well, let's get Erica to do this work. No, she's probably not the individual who wants to get out there and constantly be in this exploratory mode and then come back, and especially if you create a sales. Erica would not want to close a deal for anything. I mean, I suspect that for guys like you and me, there is a point at which the curiosity sort of has to come to a close, I guess. And you have to, that's where that strategy in front of the word solicitation really comes in, isn't it? It's that idea that I have oftentimes said to clients, sometimes you're strategically soliciting so as to get a response, maybe even a less than desirable response, so as to move the relationship in the right direction. Isn't that in some part what, and you guys know this in legal terms as well, you're doing some actions you're doing in the context of law, you're sort of playing chess with the world, right? You're sort of making moves in order to advance the conversation, but not necessarily arriving at the final outcome. Am I right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You just, in one of those, yeah, you got to be well put by saying the chess move. You're just trying to keep moving and trying to see how that move, what that you know, what the consequence of that is, and you're adjusting accordingly. But yeah, you're not saying, okay, I'm taking the straight line to get to this, you know, to this square. I gotta negotiate. Maybe I'll get over there, but maybe it'll take me over here in a new strategy. So.
Yeah, we're not playing checkers. We're playing chess, and everything's not linear, and everything doesn't have the same sort of value and doesn't have the same capability. And so every move you make, that's some of the stuff I put in that first book I wrote, was this idea that we have studied, people who study the science of expertise actually study master chess players, and what they're able to see is some of the, you know, some of the things that are going on in our heads that makes us, that does bring out some of that brilliance and stuff, is right. The ability to sort of not just see things in this very linear sort of formulaic, overly deterministic sort of way of seeing the world. Yeah.
So true.
So do you, before I let you go, it's been a fascinating conversation. You've allowed me in many ways to hijack the conversation. I've perhaps had too much coffee this morning.
No such thing.
Yeah, right. Robert, do you, being a curious chameleon, I don't know if you've had an experience. I don't know if you clarified this in the way you introduced yourself, but I've oftentimes said that fundraising sort of suffers not from having enough talent in the fundraising roles, but having a supervisory problem. Yeah. And I kind of wonder if maybe what we're lacking is we don't have enough supervisors guys like you and me, guys, gals, people who've been in the field, people like Danielle, my former boss, who've been in the field, can see the value of a study like the Curious Chameleon study and say, okay, this really clarifies the work that I'm doing and almost frames up my job description. But what if you don't work for a boss, or are there in your mind enough bosses out there now in our line of work that sort of value that curiosity?
Yeah, I'm gonna say no, it's yes, based on both personal experience, interviews with colleagues or discussions with colleagues, and discussions with folks who are new to fundraising, and hearing what kind of supervisor they had. You know, I always use the movie Glengarry Glen Ross as an example. Yep. Of, you know, always be closing, and if you've got a supervisor who's thinking that, nope, always be closing. Again, kind of going back to our discussion about, you know, the sales versus fundraising.
Yeah.
And so you talk to them like, well, I would love to have those conversations, but again, kind of goes back to metrics. My metrics are, I have to do X, Y, Z. You know, these are the things that they're measuring. So these are the things I have to do. And you ask them, well, what if you had time to really get to know this person? And then instead of getting, you know, a $10,000 gift, you got a $50,000 gift. Is that extra 6 months it took to get that? Is that a better situation? And that's a good question, you know, like for those interview questions when you're talking to a supervisor or when you're interviewing with could be your potential boss, to ask that question.
Yeah.
If I get a $10,000 gift in 2 months versus a $50,000 gift in, you know, 16 months, you know, what do you think about that? And of course, the smart interview person is going to say, well, that's, you know, $50,000 is fantastic. You know, you can get that. You know, okay, now go back and see if what they've said really aligns with, you know, what they've said in the past about what their expectations are. Because it does. I do believe that if you're in a supervisory role and you're not encouraging that curiosity and giving room for patience and growth is really kind of the big thing too. Is that patience piece of it is, I know you've got the talent to ask, you know, to be a curious chameleon, to ask those questions, to get to know the folks, to be, you know, to be strategic in your solicitations. If I give you the room to do that and you can come through, we're both going to realize better results. And if we can just replicate that amongst, you know, not just what you're doing, but your colleagues, we can get that. If everybody under my supervisory purview can do that, just think of the lift you get. It does kind of go back to, from the top down, you've got to have that curiosity. And to me, the best leaders have always been those that have that. You can see that curiosity. Yes, they're business minded. They want to get results. You know, the institution needs what they can do, but they're also approaching it from, let's take this in the best way possible so that we are satisfying, you know, our curiosity, helping our donors, and doing it in a way that really kind of grows that benefit across all channels. So,
yeah.
That wasn't too long, but the supervisory aspect of all this really does kind of resonate with me, because that's, as someone who's trying to develop talent, you know, either as a mentor or as a, you know, as a supervisor, this is important to me that folks embrace that, because that's the growth, that's the personal professional growth area for them to really succeed at.
Yeah, I think they, and again, I spent a little bit of time getting to know the sort of the basics of that particular study. I'm going to, just like I suspect you might go grab it and continue to simmer on the Curious Chameleon research as well. But I'll find it, make sure for the sake of our listeners, I'll make sure to put some links in the show notes. But there's several other characteristics that they talked about these individuals. But it is, if you think about it, it's really just that ability to be adaptable, which we would, when we think about a chameleon, that they're able to do. And it's that curiosity, which is that ability to constantly ask questions. And I don't think that fundraising has sort of settled really well into that idea of sort of living out professionally. I oftentimes am saying that I think fundraising as a profession is sort of in its messy adolescence. It hasn't sort of grown up. And I think as we become wiser, as human beings, as we become wiser, we become more comfortable with sort of that sitting back in the back, having that professional expertise, knowing we know what's going on, but being willing to sort of scan the environment. It's sort of that environmental sort of awareness of what's going on and you can't walk into a setting and be an expert on that particular part of what's going on until you know the part. You just can't. And so sometimes I think we need to put our expertise, if you will, sort of on the back burner, and go in more like, you know, a researcher, you know, a student, somebody who's learning. It's quite fascinating. Yeah.
And to bring it full circle about, you know, backing into fundraising, I just had this discussion yesterday with a colleague about working with, you know, we were kind of reviewing how we got into fundraising, and, you know, now he's like, yeah, it's really strange now. Now you actually see, you know, college students who are actually pursuing, there's a track for going into fundraising.
Yes, there is.
And you think, wow, that's great. But wait a minute, when we came into fundraising, we brought life experience in other areas to the work we were doing, working with individuals. You know, like, you can't replicate, I can't sit in the college classroom, hear a professor talk, or actually do some, you know, maybe some clinicals and say, yep, got it, I'm ready to go. There's a little bit, you know, there's not a lot of nuance that goes into this. So we were just kind of waxing about, yeah, it'd be great if you could, you know, and again, I guess it's really kind of the role of mentorship at that point. How do you find new fundraisers who are eager to do this and who want to be at that level? But again, kind of patience as a mentor, telling them, you know, here's some things that you need, you can focus on, that I recommend to you that you focus on some aspects so that you begin to grow and start to pull in those nuances that you need to think about. Again, curiosity for on your own behalf about how you're going to pursue this profession that you say you love and you want to grow into. Here's some things to think about pulling into that and growing in that space.
Yeah, I have oftentimes said to younger fundraisers, I've said to them, get in front of the donor as quickly as you can. Not because what I call arm's length fundraising, not because these tactics don't work, not because galas, golf tournaments, you know, grant writing, online giving, you know, direct response, not because those things don't work and not because they don't play a role, but to specialize in those places oftentimes puts us at such an arm's length from the donor that we don't get to be curious. It's just a machine. Right. You're just a technician is really what you're doing. And inevitably you sort of arrive at a peak. What Epstein in his book, Range, talks about, you join this cult of early specialization is what he talks about. You sort of early specialize in this highly technical component of what it is you're doing. And you miss out on those opportunities that to sort of exceed beyond competency and sort of open up that. You know, it's the same thing we expect of leadership. You know, leaders oftentimes sort of have that first ladder of competency. And then one author talks about the idea of sort of moving to a second ladder. And that second ladder is a lot of the characteristics that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes or so. Right. Yeah. Right. Robert, I have really enjoyed this conversation. You could keep me going. I could probably keep you going for a while, but we've probably already lost some of our listeners. They don't stick with us more than about 40 minutes. If somebody's listened to our conversation today and they're interested in reaching out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
You can find me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way. Look me up, Robert King, and that will be the University of Iowa Center for Advancement. Feel free to reach out. Always glad to connect. Love working, and just I love this profession so much. It's just great to connect with colleagues and other professionals and really start to, again, be curious about them and have them curious about what we're doing.
It's certainly been a pleasure, Robert. You're always welcome back.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it. Take care.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.